Welcome. This is the, I'm Brian Wong with the Bay Area Anti-Trafficking Coalition. So if this is, you realize you're on the wrong flight, this is the time to get off and go somewhere else. I'm going to give kind of an overview of the anti-trafficking movement as we see it going around in the Bay Area. There's still a couple of comfortable seats over here. These guys found the comfortable sofas. Before we get going, I'd like to just get a real quick idea of kind of who's here. Because there are some familiar faces, but I don't know most of you. So just kind of geographically, how many of you are not from... this is bugging me. No. Well, they're recording, so I need the mic. Let me just turn the game down a little bit. Check. So how many of you are not from the greater Bay Area, like the nine counties that are usually considered the Bay Area? Oh, quite a few. Wow, all right. How about South Bay? I live in the South Bay. How many people are from that area?
A few.
Yes, raise your hand. Yes, South Bay. East Bay, kind of Alameda. Oh, all right. Peninsula? Any North Bay? Nice. All right, did I miss anybody? Where?
Santa Cruz.
So I don't know, is Santa Cruz considered Bay Area usually? I would still. So you're the closest, Monterey, Salinas. So yeah, thanks. Good, welcome, you guys. I'm going to be... If you see me looking at my phone, I'm not checking Facebook. I just... I have notes on here. And normally I... This is probably too much information, but normally I have... normally I put notes on my iPad, but... A little digression. My son's, the computer my son only uses is in the shop for repairs. And if I took the laptop and the iPad this weekend, my kids would freak out. So I left the iPad home for my kids and I've got the laptop, but my notes are on my phone. So, all right, so before we get going even more, we've kind of jumped on the bandwagon and I'm going to take a selfie with you guys all. So, smile if you want to be on our social media. Get most of you if I can. All right. Okay, we're good. Now we can go. Let me pull out one visual aid just to let you guys think about, and we'll get to it in a minute. Can you guys see what this is? I'll pass it around if you promise not to take it. $100 bill? Keep that in mind. We'll come back to that. I don't usually carry that in my wallet. But so if you think about taking my wallet, it's not usually in there. So this morning we're going to, I want to make this pretty relevant to you all, so there's a couple of things I think are important for us to talk about today, and I'm going to do those at the beginning and at the end probably, but in the middle and the rest of it, I want to make sure that I kind of address the questions that are on your mind or the things that you're thinking about, so I want you to feel free to interrupt me and ask questions. Think about the stuff that you might... I'll answer as best I can for whatever questions come up. And if you don't have questions, that's okay, but I think you'll be kind of bored just hearing me drone on for an hour. So, and this is an hour. Is that what's in the 12:15? That's what's in the schedule? Okay. So what I'm going to do first is, you know, if you saw my colleague Betty Ann this morning in the general session, she talked about some of the myths we come across. So we, at the Bay Area Anti-Trafficking Coalition, I'll tell you more about us in a little bit, we go around a lot speaking to people and... we see that there's this whole spectrum of awareness that's happening. And, you know, some people have never heard of human trafficking, and some of you are very engaged with the issue. But all along the way, there's some different misconceptions and myths that we run into, and we often have to help people work through those and understand the reality of the issue. So I'm going to run through a few. Betty Ann mentioned a few earlier and stole some of the thunder, but this is by no means a comprehensive list or a priority list, but just some things. What the goal of this is, it's to help me give you some of the facts and figures in a more engaging way than just kind of systematically going through stuff. So I'm going to address some of these, and feel free to ask questions as we move along. But here's one. We talked about this briefly, that trafficking only happens in other countries. And so we see that people are on this awareness journey where they see it first happening in places like Eastern Europe or Africa or Southeast Asia. And then they start realizing as they hear about it on the media or whatever that it's actually happening in the U.S. And then we also help them take the next step to realize that we all have a personal stake in this issue, that it doesn't, it's not something we can hold at arm's length. And true that if you go to developing countries where poverty and corruption is more in your face, it's a lot more obvious to see the issue. And here in the Western world, here in the United States, we are much better at kind of hiding our dirty laundry and pushing it to the side. So you might have to look a little deeper for it. But as many of you realize, it's there as you begin to dig. And here in the Bay Area, often we see that people are lured here by jobs, and they're deceived because they think they're going to come to the U.S. and get this great job to provide for their families. They often come out of poor countries, and they have expenses they can't pay for. They have they can't feed their families. They got medical things to pay for. Sometimes one of the typical cases, here's a few faces of what it might look like in the Bay Area and elsewhere that you may be from around California. Domestic servitude was the first human trafficking case to be tried in Northern California in federal courts here. And it was a case in Walnut Creek, affluent suburban area. And cases like this, often someone's brought in from another country to work in someone's home, and they are there to cook and clean, take care of the kids and things like that. But what happens is they aren't paid. They're abused, they're made to sleep on the floor or sleep in the garage, they aren't fed well, they are made to work 16, 20-hour days, and often they're threatened with deportation, they're threatened, they may not know the language, so they don't know who to trust. Law enforcement in their country may be corrupt, so they feel they're enslaved, literally. And so this has happened in a bunch of suburban places around the Bay Area, heard cases in Southern California. And so these are labor trafficking victims. And fortunately, in the case in Walnut Creek, the trafficker who was from Peru and trafficked this woman in from Peru was convicted under trafficking laws. And the person was rescued because she used to take the kids to school every day. And someone at the staff at the school noticed that she would wear the same things every day. She wouldn't talk to people, make eye contact. She looked very disheveled, and she got suspicious. And so that's just a great example of, as public awareness grows and we know what to look for, and Betty Ann mentioned this morning, we know what to look for, the signs, and who to call. This person, the school called it in, and this trafficker was caught, and that person was released. So that's one example. Another example is people come over here for jobs, and to do that from another country, they often pay recruiters this huge fee to get the job. They come over, they find out they're getting charged these exorbitant interest rates, they get fees tacked on for food and housing and transportation, whatever. And what ends up happening is they are never able to make enough money to pay back the debt they owe. And so this whole dream they had of getting a job to send money back home to help their families, now that's stripped away from them by their traffickers, because now they're just working here and they can't pay back their own debt and their families are left without them, and they are a form of slave labor. And you find them in agriculture, in construction, in restaurants, in hotels, skilled nursing facilities, all over the Bay Area. Someone may be offered a job to work at a restaurant or something, and they come here and they end up working in a residential brothel. And so there are homes like that around the Bay Area. I'll show you, I think I have a picture of one that the San Jose Police Department shows. It looks like a home in my neighborhood, and their women are kept there for men to come as customers to buy sex from them. And often those brothels they're ethnically oriented, so it'll be a brothel of Vietnamese ladies or Latina ladies or whatever. Or someone thinks they're coming over for a modeling job or something, and they end up working at a massage parlor. You might have just heard yesterday on the news there's a big raid on massage parlors in Alameda County. And the Polaris Project, who runs the National Human Trafficking Hotline, I heard them talking earlier this year about how they estimated there are 5,000 massage parlors around the U.S. that are fronts for sex trafficking. And so a lot of those are here in California. I don't know the exact numbers, but that's another area that a lot of you probably have seen massage parlors pop up in your towns and your cities over the past few years. And some of them are legit, but some of them are not. Nick Smith. And we talked about this earlier in the general session. Trafficking victims are also domestic. There's I just heard another stat recently, back in February, that domestic minor sex trafficking victims, there's another acronym you should be aware of in this field, which is CSEC, commercially sexually exploited children. So any minor who is prostituted is a human trafficking victim. So anyone under 18 who's being sold commercially for sex. The cases in California, the statistic was this. In 2012, the CSEC cases in California, 72% of them were American-born U.S. citizens. And so it's happening to our children right here in the US. It's not just people coming in from other countries. And it happens to all kinds of at-risk youth, which I'll talk more about. But for example, foster kids, runaways, kids who are in gangs. I have a friend who's a pastor in the San Jose area with a gang ministry, and he can point out two geographical spots in San Jose where gangs bring girls to sell on the streets for sex. And so everybody's making money off of this, including gangs, for example. And I'm finding out more and more that all these cities have different tracks. I mean, I guess if that's not part of your world, you don't realize how prevalent street prostitution still is. It's happening online a lot more now, but they're still out on the streets. Or we're just hearing Santa Rosa PD talk about there's a track in Santa Rosa where the prostitutes are. I live near San Jose, and I just found out there's four different tracks in San Jose. I only knew one before, but so that's happening all over, both online and on the streets. And those are mostly domestic kids who are getting trafficked. Another thing that we often talk about is that domestic trafficking victims are only from urban areas like San Francisco. Oakland is infamous for its prostitution on the street, San Jose. But it's happening to suburban people too. I met someone recently who was trafficked in San Rafael. She was a 19-year-old, affluent, blonde, white girl, and she was trafficked out of a wealthy home with affluent clients for a few years before she was able to escape. And there's examples of that in suburbia all around. So it's not just an urban issue. And this other one, this is often it's a hot issue with people, but the whole idea that prostitutes are there by choice and they're doing it to make money and that's what they want to do is just completely wrong. And as long as there's someone who's making money off of them, exploiting them, then they are a trafficking victim. If they have a pimp, then they are being trafficked. And pimps' techniques and recruiting and everything they do, the controlling techniques, are getting more and more well documented. And they use just all kinds of psychological manipulation. They don't have to be in chains to be trafficked. And people often say, they're not chained up, they're not locked in a room, why can't they walk away? And it's so much more complicated than that. The way that they abuse them, the way that they violate them, the way that they degrade them and dehumanize them to a point where they feel like they have no other option but to do what they're doing, and that's their lot in life. And they form this bond, this crazy dysfunctional bond with their trafficker, because the trafficker makes them depend on them for everything. And so even when they're rescued, they often want to go back because that's all that they're comfortable with. That's all they know and that's all they trust. And so it's a really pretty sick world that prostitutes live in. Only the wealthy buy slaves. That's why I brought this out. So the $100 bill is just an example of a few years ago, a guy named Kevin Bales, who has an organization called Free the Slaves, he did this study that estimated that the average price of a slave around the world is $90. So with this bill, I could buy someone. It'd be more here in America, it'd be less in, say, India or something, but I don't know, that's eye-opening, and it reminds me that people are just treated as disposable commodities. They're something that can be bought, used, and thrown away, totally contrary to a biblical worldview of how God made all men and women, children, in his image, and we have inherent value and beauty that people are just abusing and throwing away. Because they're making money, there's $32 billion a year is what it's estimated that traffickers make selling people every year. Last one. So I think often we see people saying, you know, I don't go to prostitutes, I don't hire slaves, so I don't contribute to the problem. And it's such a big kind of other issue that there's nothing I can do. And, you know, with awareness growing as it is, and many of you have seen the media is talking about it more, there are people who still don't know what human trafficking is, and Betty Ann talked about that this morning, but more and more people are going to hear about it. And once you become aware of it, you have the choice of either saying, I don't care about it, I'm going to ignore it, or I'm going to do something about it. And for those who stay in this camp of I don't care about it, I'm going to ignore it, at some point they have to face some realities in their life where they're going to realize, hey, my neighbor's daughter went missing, or they're going to realize the restaurant I go to hired slave labor, or they're going to realize the cosmetics I buy have ingredients that are mined by kids in India, or they're going to realize that the girls that I look at in pornography are actually trafficking victims, or they're going to realize that The media that I consume is degrading to women, just like Eugene was talking about. The media just twists the whole image and the value and beauty of women around. And in that way, I do have a stake in this issue, and I do contribute to the problem, and I can do something to fix it. And what we at the BAATC do as we talk to people is we say everybody's got a unique contribution they can make. Everybody has a unique sphere of influence, unique gifts and interests that they can contribute to the issue. And we all have a part to play, and we all need to step up to that part if we're going to make a difference and have an impact in the movement. So I'm going to break a second in case some questions have come up as we've talked about this, or if you guys have some other things. Yeah, right here.
The first story, the Peruvian woman, was she deported?
That's a good question. Somebody else know? No, she was not. Restitution. Thanks, Rose. So,
and then the second half of the question, what am I doing right now in my daily routine in the Bay Area where I'm contributing to human trafficking? You know, I mean, I go down to Home Depot and I hire some guy to help me do stuff in the yard or whatever. Like, I'm not aware of it, but maybe I'm contributing.
Well, so back to the victim real quickly. So the part of the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, which is a federal law enacted in 2000, was to create visas for trafficking victims to be able to stay while everything's being processed. So they don't get deported back to the place where they're going to get trafficked again. That's one thing the government has tried to do. It's likely that just on a daily basis that you have touched something made by slaves so far today. The materials in my iPhone, the metal, has often been mined by people in Africa as slave laborers. Or the coffee, I don't know if the coffee here is fair trade, but the coffee you drank might have been picked by child laborers.
Is there a good website?
Yeah, so I have some resources for that. Remind me if I don't get to it, but I'll get to that. Wait, right here first.
So one thing that several of us were talking about before we walked up here was massage parlors. Mm-hmm. So in my mind, massage parlors equate to trafficking and prostitution. So why are there so many massage parlors, and why isn't the law enforcement actually doing something about it?
There's a couple answers, I think. Well, first of all, a lot of them are legit and give massages. I've been to massage parlors, and some of them give good massages. But there's an interesting, and some of you might know more about this than me. We just found out recently there is a law that was enacted a few years ago that changed the whole, and the legal stuff is kind of over my head usually, but it changed the whole way that massage parlors are regulated. And so, for example, in the city I live in, Santa Clara, I think in 2008 there were like six massage parlors, and it went to 33 in the past few years. And so there's some movements to change to sunset this law, which is ending, I think, the end of this year, so that cities can get more control back over how they regulate massage parlors, because there has been an explosion of them because they're regulated differently now. That's the small one part of the answer. We had a question over, here first.
So you mentioned the average price of a slave around the world being $90. Does that mean that we can buy them $9 and set them free?
So that's a good question. So that's kind of a philosophy of that's part of the whole approach thing. It's not, if we just went around and we spent the money to buy everybody and free them, that doesn't mean that more people aren't going to be enslaved. The better question to ask is how do we traffic proof them so that they're not going to be enslaved? And that's a bigger question of development. There's economic issues, there's cultural issues and things like that, so that just buying them out of slavery is not necessarily the answer to ending slavery. Does that make sense?
Okay.
It would help that one, though.
It would help that one, but there's more, but yeah, it would help that one. I'm not going to go too deeply into that. Sure. It's not. That is a complicated question, but it's a good question, and I mean, it's an insightful question.
So sorry. Also, can I ask again? So is this maybe not the average price to just kind of buy them, period?
No, this is the price that it would take to rehabilitate, restore them, and bring them back into a fruitful position where they won't be trafficked again. This isn't just to buy them. That's the price. Vanessa, you had something real quick.
Yeah, two things. So I recently went to a massage parlor in Gilroy. Someone treated me, and the prices seemed so low. That, to me, was a red flag that there probably is some labor trafficking going on here, because the quality of the service was really good, and then it was like $15 to get a massage. It just didn't seem normal.
Sure.
Do we have any guidelines that you know of on the labor trafficking end that could help us detect
Right, and it's hard because often they don't speak English, right? And so it's hard to talk to them, and you don't know what the situation is about their being here to work, whether they're here legally and whether they're being exploited. I'm not sure specific guidelines other than this. That's a great opportunity to call the National Human Trafficking Hotline, which is 1-888-3737-888, and I'll talk about that more. But they not only can keep track of kind of the different calls that come in, and they can kind of filter. They have their own protocols to understand when a case would be trafficking, and they can mobilize the local or federal law enforcement when necessary. So, this corner.
Maybe you can give me some professional feedback. I'm working with 22, 23-year-old girls who are addicts, but they were maybe prostituted or trafficked, heavily when they were 12, 13 years old. But now when I'm trying to get them help and services with different organizations, the Dream Center, they said, well, are they currently underneath a pimp, and or are they doing this out of their own free will? I said, well, they're still considered a victim of human trafficking because of the upbringing where they came from. They said, no, they're currently doing this for drugs, so we're going to classify them in this other program, and they're not really qualified for the health and services. What's your perspective on that?
That would be a better question for people who are kind of doing more victim services, of which there are a lot around the Bay Area somewhere. Each county kind of addresses how they provide those services differently, and so it's not as simple.
What's your perspective?
Whether they should get services if they were previously trafficked?
Yes.
I think, without, that's off the top of my head, but there's probably something I'm missing, but I understand just regulations saying depending on how you categorize them, they're going to get different.
Okay. So
services.
It's still pretty gray area, you would imagine?
I would imagine. But I would want to talk to more of our partners who are service providers to get better insight into that.
So you might be getting to this, but I was wondering, when you were talking about different people giving different contributions to the problem, does your organization help align those? Or how are you, let's say somebody has, had money to give, and somebody had professional training to give and all those things. Can you help kind of align?
Yeah, so that is a big part of our vision. So let me back up and talk about kind of why we exist. When I met Betty Ann, who's sitting right here, she was planning a Freedom Summit beginning of 2011, and at that conference, we realized there are all these people in the Bay Area. There were 1,700 individuals there. There are 30-some organizations at the expo. There are hundreds of churches represented, different schools and community groups, and we realized that we are missing out on the opportunity to get everybody working together, that there's a potential that we could maximize if we all collaborated, which wasn't happening. And so part of that whole collaboration effort is to help people get plugged into the right way. So someone who wants to do such and such will point them to that area. Someone who has resources for this, someone has gifting for this, someone who wants to donate to this. We help everybody kind of find their connection so they have their unique place. Does that help that answer?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And when is that?
Oh, the Freedom Summit?
Yes.
Oh, so that's something we do all the time. The connecting part. But we will have one coming up next spring.
Next spring?
We've been on a 2-year cycle.
And so what else do you guys do other than the Freedom Summit as far as throughout the year to help connect people in order to find out, basically connect with where they're going?
So we're building the network in one sense, working with all the different. There's a lot of regional, just kind of the good news is there's regional bubbles of collaboration happening all over the Bay Area. And our vision is to see these bubbles kind of coalesce into one giant strategic human trafficking collaboration. So, and then at the same time, we're also doing a lot of public awareness. So we're out speaking all the time, or we're doing training events throughout the year with the goal that public awareness is huge for a couple of reasons. One, a movement can't really get started. People can't do something until they're aware, right? That's pretty obvious. But then, we've heard from law enforcement, for example, that when they bring human trafficking cases to court, it's nice to have an educated jury pool of citizens to choose from. Because often, our criminal justice system. Since human trafficking laws are relatively new, California didn't have its first one until 2005 or 2006. I think I have that on the slide. Not everybody knows how to prosecute a human trafficking case. We had a San Jose police officer tell us that he came to court one day with a trafficking case, and the judge asked him to come to the bench to explain to the judge about human trafficking. And it's not the judge's fault. It's just that it's a process, and it takes time for everybody to learn what to do with. People know what to do with a murder case or a robbery case, right? But not everybody knows what to do with a human trafficking case. So law enforcement would appreciate juries that they can pull from people who actually have some knowledge of trafficking in the first place, so they don't have to start from ground zero.
Although I imagine the defending attorney would put up objections to people who are really knowledgeable.
Possibly.
And exclude them from the jury.
Although, yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I haven't been in one of those courtrooms. Betty Ann.
I think one of the unique things here in the Bay Area is that in a lot of places where the interest about human trafficking is growing, especially among the church, the immediate response is we need to have aftercare. We need to have a place for the victims to go, right? And so that's super important. But what Ryan's going to talk about today and what your question about kind of how do we get these groups to work together is we categorize it in two ways. One, there's a continuum of care for the survivor. So it's when that person is rescued that the organizations that are available in that region are actually not punching each other out to help that victim. We're actually seeing in regions where people are like, we want to help that person because then we're going to get donor dollars and we're going to be able to stay alive as an organization instead of being victims-centered and really caring for that victim. So there's a lot of nonprofits that we help line up, so it's not everybody focusing in on the first 18 months of care. And then you go, well, what happens to that woman when she graduates out of that program? What housing does she go to? Where's transitional housing? What about vocational training? In a lot of these programs, there's jewelry making and things like that, but ultimately, is that a profession that that woman could stay in for a long period of time? That's questionable. So we have to help people on a long path, right? So that's the continuum of care for the victim. But then on the other side, which Brian's going to speak into, which is what our Freedom Summit does and other things, is there's a continuum of care for the advocate, which is the person who reads a book, the person who hears their first talk on trafficking, the first time they hear about this issue, or then they go to an academy, and they're ready to do the next step. You're going to find that also in your faith communities, people are going to be at different levels. There's going to be the 1.0, just I heard about it for the first time, and you're also going to have people who are like, I'm ready to be a foster parent. You know, and so you're going to have these different arrays. So I would think of it in two continuums, and so sometimes that's where the work of the BAATC, that's where it's both. We help coordinate a lot of those organizations where we want them to work together well on behalf of the victim, and then we also want to work with advocates to say, what does it mean to walk with you on your journey of learning more, so that whether it changes your vocation, whether it impacts your conversations with families, whether you start your own nonprofit, whether you go to, you know, do XYZ, there's a continuum of care for the advocate as well.
And do you guys have like a set building place where we could come and be able to connect with anybody else or even just get more resources from you guys and what you guys know and what you guys are trying to do?
Yeah.
Like a physical location that we're able to...
Not so much right now.
The BAATC is standing in this spot right here. This is us.
But we do a lot of speaking engagements and we love to have people. We do kind of make it available where we are on Bay at different times, so that people can come and like talk to us and questions they have, and we're trying to pay it forward online.
I'm going to have brochures. I'm going to have Betty Ann pass out brochures, which I'll forget otherwise. Just with contact information from us, for us, pronouns. So we'll have a table, the Resource Center, too. Feel free to come by later. We'll talk more. You have a question back there? Yes, oh, definitely.
Maybe like miracle-style prayer or prayer warrior groups.
Okay.
Or something.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, Betty Ann's passing out two different things. One, the trifold is a brochure with information. The other one is an action step card. It's just got ideas of next steps on the back. The hotline's on there. There's some consumer buying resources on there, too. The idea of the men... Let me get to that. I'll get to that. Remind me if I don't. I'm going to move on. We'll do more questions in a little bit. While you guys are looking at that, let me just share a little bit, kind of back up a little bit. The way that, just to make this a little more personal, I hadn't heard of trafficking until about 2008. In 2008, I was a pastor at a church in Los Altos. I was on a mission trip to China. I was working with orphans, disabled orphans in China. And if you know anything about China, those disabled orphans in China, they're the epitome of the abandoned, the marginalized, the cast out. There's a little boy that I worked with that came back with me, not physically, but in my head, named Tao Tao. And the staff called him Moses because they had literally found him floating down a river in a basket because his parents had cast him out. And so that just created in me a new broken heart for the way that God's heart breaks for the sin in this world. And we started, our family started getting more involved in compassion and justice ministries. We saw the film called Call and Response. How many of you have seen Call and Response? Okay. So that was kind of our first introduction to the issue, and we started getting the church more involved. My wife took a group to Thailand, and a couple years later, we found ourselves feeling like God was saying, I've got a new season of ministry for you, deeper into my heart of compassion, but we weren't sure what that was yet. And so we felt like he wasn't really going to make that clear till we were in a place where we just had to really trust in him and depend on him. And so I left my position at the church. We spent a few months exploring and trying to figure out what that was. And that's when I met Betty Ann, and that's when we realized that there was this opportunity in the Bay Area to create an organization that would help us collectively make an impact with all the people who are doing the work. And it's amazing to see what's really sustaining in this effort is that there are so many people doing the good work. And I was just talking yesterday to someone about, even though we don't have all the numbers of is slavery increasing or decreasing in the Bay Area, we don't know all the numbers. The one thing we do know is that there are more and more people getting involved, and there are more and more people doing amazing things to fight trafficking. And that's what, in the midst of talking about such a dark and heavy subject, that's what I get excited about talking about, that people are actually stepping up and taking the fight to the traffickers, to the evil in this world and the darkness and the sin that underlies and all around the issue of trafficking. Let me see what's next. Oh, so real quickly, I don't know. I think most of you are kind of above the 101 level, but I'm not going to go through the stats. But just to make sure we're kind of on the same page with a definition, when one person is being exploited for their work, whether that's sex or another type of labor, by either of these three means, this is what law enforcement kind of looks at: force, fraud, or coercion. Then we've got a human trafficking case. So, I mean, just kind of a simple paraphrase of the definition of trafficking that I often use. So force would be what doesn't normally happen, but it's kind of, you imagine in Hollywood where someone gets grabbed off the street and put a bag over their head and thrown in a van. But that's not typically how it works. The fraud issue comes in play. They're offered a job. That's not what they expected. Coercion is when they're being threatened. They're like, you work in our brothel, or I'll get your sister, or I know where your parents live. I'm going to go after them if you don't do this. So that's just kind of, so we're all kind of on the same page of a definition. Oh, so I'm not going to go, I was originally going to do two different breakouts, one about the church specifically. So I've got a bunch of scripture verses in here, but if you want to kind of talk more about that, come by the table. I'm not going to cover all the, we encounter churches of all different kind of, along the spectrum too, of doing justice stuff is kind of the liberal agenda, and then churches that are really engaged in justice and like do it, and they're out there, they're being God's hand and feet in a compassionate way and living out the gospel and to the brokenness of this world. And I'm not saying that one's better than the other, but I'm saying often it's helpful as you engage with your churches to have a biblical basis to talk and kind of have a toolkit of, this is what scripture says about justice, this is what the God of justice looks like that we worship. And so as we talk to people in our congregations, as we talk to our leadership, we talk to our pastors, we have kind of the tools to say, I'm not just saying this because I have an opinion or a conviction, I'm saying this because this is what I believe the Bible tells us. So I'm going to kind of skip through these, but be happy to tell you more about them. There's one I'm going to stop on and explain. And this isn't like a deep biblical exegesis of this verse, but you'll notice three things in this verse that I think are helpful: acting justly, loving mercy, and walking humbly. And so if you look at these three things, this is what God requires of us as what is good. And we start with the last one, walk humbly. And if you look at walking humbly as kind of discipleship and evangelism, helping people come into a walk with Jesus and helping them to walk with Jesus on a journey to become more like him, then the church, if you look at it like in a big circle of how much time and resources the church puts into walking humbly, the church has become pretty good at that. We're good at discipleship, evangelism. We spend a lot of time, we spend a lot of money on doing that. So the bubble is pretty big, the circle. If you go back to loving mercy and you consider that kind of acts of compassion, of reaching out to the brokenness in the world, the symptoms of sin, the people that are hungry, the people who are homeless, the people who are dying. And the church has gotten pretty good. It's not as big of a circle as walking humbly, but it's a big circle where the church has invested a lot of time and money in caring for those in this world who are hurting, right? But then this first one, acting justly, I think the church with a capital C, is still trying to figure out what it means to act justly. And that's a much smaller circle that the church hasn't quite figured out very well, at least not on a large scale basis, of how to act justly, how to be, and it's very biblical in that we are to be a voice for the voiceless, we are to stand up for the marginalized. God has a heart for the alien, the foreigner, the widow, and the orphan. And we see that throughout scripture, and often as the church, I think we don't know how to do that in our ministries, in our daily lives. And so it's an opportunity. The reason I say that is because I think the smaller circle of acting justly is an opportunity for the church to step into and step up to actually put some time and energy into that and live into the calling to follow a God of justice so that we can do all these things are important, but so that we can act justly, but we can also, while also loving mercy and walking humbly. So hopefully that's kind of a helpful way to think about it a little bit as far as the church's call. I talked about kind of how we see people's journey going from global to local to home, and then how the good news is that the things we can do on a daily basis, whether it's changing the things we buy or getting involved, volunteering or donating or whatever it is, can have an impact locally and have an impact globally. So we have, we would like to cast this vision for public awareness, where a lot of you live in a neighborhood where there's a neighborhood watch program, and so you know if your across street neighbor has someone that's climbing over the fence that you call 911, right? So, and Betty, I mentioned this. We would envision the Bay Area to create a human trafficking watch where every citizen of the Bay Area, every citizen in California, for all of you, knows what human trafficking is, knows what the signs are, and knows who to call. So that not only do we potentially rescue more victims because we become the eyes and ears of law enforcement. You hear about like the raid in Alameda County yesterday. I don't know the details, but obviously there are public people who called in tips so that they could investigate all these because there are just no law enforcement agencies that can be everywhere and find everything. And they depend on the public for help. And so not only will we potentially rescue more victims, but we send the message to traffickers saying we are not going to let that happen here in our city, in our town, in our region, because we're the eyes and ears, we're looking out. Okay, so as you think about how you might want to get more involved in the issue, this is the kind of last thing I really want to talk about, and then we can do more questions. We like to break up the issue into three parts. We find it's helpful to people. So aftercare, intervention, and prevention. So the first one, aftercare, is it's taking a survivor and helping them through the long process of finding healing, getting therapy, counseling, immediate medical care, housing assistance, getting job skill training, all that stuff to restore their dignity from what has been stripped away from them and the trauma that they've gone through. So just for examples, there's two dedicated shelters for aftercare here in the Bay Area. And there's more. There's three or four kind of on the horizon that may be opening up, which is good news. But Freedom House, they're here. They have in the Resource Center. They have a home for women, and they just opened a home for minors. New Day for Children is a home for minors. But and I'll explain this in a minute, but there are more and more organizations that actually kind of do aftercare that aren't necessarily a shelter. For example, SAGE does work in San Francisco. Missy does work in Oakland. But they blend in together with these other organizations that do intervention. So a lot of these groups here, and I'll talk about this more in a minute. I mean, these things kind of go together because there's a lot of groups that help people get out of situations, but they don't just leave them once they get out. They walk with them and they do mentoring and stuff like that, like Love Never Fails, who's here, and they're doing some breakouts because they do not only work reaching out to girls on the streets who are in prostitution and trafficking situations, but then they walk with them after they've decided to come out because Justice Matters does that in the Tenderloin in San Francisco. Baywar is a first responder in Oakland that they go out, so when the human trafficking hotline gets a tip and they want to mobilize people, they send Pat out from Baywar to go with the Oakland Police Department to intervene and rescue someone. And then Baywar is the one who kind of takes them as a service provider and helps them through the whole process of aftercare. So I'm seeing that these blend more and more together, and I don't know. Originally, it seemed like a little bit better distinction, but they do blend. So prevention is kind of it's a much bigger category. Vulnerable populations, we mentioned a little bit already, kind of if foster youth, there's a lot of at-risk kids, gangs, runaways, whatnot. If you're doing, a lot of your churches may have ministries doing stuff with these populations, and it's not called anti-trafficking, but you're doing prevention stuff because you're helping people not enter into the trafficking system. We, like Betty Ann mentioned, We can do great work helping victims, and we need to, and there's a lack of resources for that, for the number of victims there are, but if we just keep taking them out, they're just gonna keep coming back in the other side. So prevention is huge. I'll come back to consumer choice. Demand, so talking about why men are out there buying sex, there's a good resource called demandforum.net, and it lists out, I think, 7 or 8 different approaches to stopping the demand for sex buying, and where it's happening in different places around the country, and ideas that you may want to take into your area. But I think the church is poised to enter this. And I'm still kind of waiting to see how the church really gets engaged, because the church is a place where men can come together in an accountable relationship and community where they can talk about the deep inner issues that are causing men to go out and buy sex and address it in a way that they can be healed and not be out there so that the pimps are making money. So I would encourage you, if you have a vibrant men's ministry, or if you have recovery ministries at your church, that this is an area, as they talk about sex addiction, how pornography and prostitution and trafficking are, they're not all the same thing, but they're integrally related, and how men have a piece in that, then that can be a very deep way that churches can approach the demand side. Does that help with your question a little bit?
Yes. Okay. I was also just wondering about the numbers. Do we have a sense of any numbers?
For... I don't know data. I mean, every organization kind of can tell you how many people they've served, but we don't know what the actual count is out there.
When we have girls in custody and they're going through the court systems, I've thrown out to probation, the judges, hey, please send these girls who are coming out of trafficking to Freedom House or New Day for Children. And they pretty much go, stay out of our business. We're sending them to a group home, you know, in Utah, Pennsylvania, because there's less strict, you know, stringent laws on what care, good care looks like. California actually has pretty good care laws. Can you guys help me get involved with how to change the judges and probation's perspective of, you know, an actual certified aftercare?
Yeah, that's a great question. So a good example is, so in each county does it differently. So it would be kind of on a county by county basis to bring whatever task forces or coalitions that are already working together or need to work together to develop a common protocol that works, that is victim-centric and that's trauma-informed, to help them move their, especially their juveniles, through the court system in a healthy way.
So to get on Girls Initiative or
to protect them. Like, yeah, and so, but so for example, there's a group, it's a nonprofit in San Jose that associated with a church, and they've brought this, real long story short, they brought to Santa Clara County a feasibility study for CSEC care. And I was just talking to the guy yesterday, and God has brought this amazing favor on them to talk to like almost every county supervisor, city council member in San Jose, congress people to come together, and they just formed a human trafficking commission. But they're working with the policymakers and the service providers in the South Bay and the law enforcement, FBI and SJPD are both really behind them to create the model they have of aftercare for juveniles that I think could be kind of a model for places around the country. So it's possible, but yeah, we can talk more about that offline. And
the Bay Area kind of sets the trend for
a lot of stuff like that. Yeah, Vanessa first.
I was just kidding, but I don't want to take up too much.
No, time. Vanessa and Love Never Fails. No, they're doing.
I'm sorry.
No, don't be. They are doing not just, they do the street outreach, they do mentoring, they're offering life skills, they're doing mentoring with guys and search and rescue stuff. So in just a couple years, I think, you know, God has just raised them up as an amazing partner, especially in Alameda County. Wait, did you have a question first before
yeah,
these guys?
What's the average age of entry, like, especially for
Yeah, so the statistic is about 13 years old is what they say. Girls are first brought into prostitution. Yeah, so that's them again. I'm glad Vanessa's here, because they're doing that in middle schools, and their program is funny. So go to their table and talk to them later.
Actually, Vanessa's doing a breakout on that later today.
That's true.
Okay,
cool.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering, what is the name of the nonprofit that's doing that work in San Jose?
Gateway Community Outreach.
I was curious if you could give these talks to law enforcement, and how supportive are they?
So, yeah, law enforcement has they're at varying levels of training too. And we're actually in the process of trying to determine how extensive law enforcement training has been. If you remember, Prop 35 was on the ballot a year and a half ago. That mandated law enforcement training. And so there is some basic law enforcement training that's going out that's supposed to be done throughout the state this year. But there are definitely some departments have a lot of training. None of them have enough people. Like San Jose has one person that's on the human trafficking task force or whatever they're called, department. So none of them, they're all under-resourced, but more than that we can get trained, we're happy to help them get the training that they need. Let me mention a couple more things. We'll take more questions. Legal advocacy is something anyone here who can vote can have a voice. So just recently, their IGM last week was up in Sacramento doing advocacy for more laws. California Against Slavery was up there a couple weeks ago. And I think you guys were up there doing a couple of bills that are trying to be passed in California. There are many more laws that need to be passed to protect victims and many more laws that need to be passed to punish the perpetrators just because it's such a multifaceted issue and there are different ways that it needs to be looked at. And so as citizens, you can be educated on that and you can call your legislators and let them know that you're behind these.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So, like I mentioned, there's the bill that's hopefully going to be going away after this year to help change how those are licensed. And I think you kind of have to work city by city then to develop. Polaris Project, the National Human Trafficking Hotline, has model ordinances for massage parlors that you could look at. But you go before your city council, and if they are behind you, you can work together to develop those city by city ordinances for massage parlors.
The state should be more involved in that.
I think so. I'm. I'm going to defer to that because I think that the bill that is a problem made it kind of a statewide thing and took the power away from cities, but I may be. So I don't know all the ins and outs of that, but there's probably pros and cons.
I was just going to say it would be nice, too, if online, you know, the ads that say that they're masseuse ads and they're completely nude, they should have like a warning that says, you know, this masseuse is not certified. Like,
some type of certification. So the whole thing that's being online, so in a way it's easier for traffickers, they don't have to put the girls on the streets, but in a way, when law enforcement is diligent about it, it's easier for them to just go when they can online and they can do stings and stuff like that. So there's, and there are groups that are kind of working on how do we identify, especially online, the really kind of the low-hanging fruit is to identify those girls who are being advertised who are underage. Because you get the adult prostitution and there's kind of more controversy, but there's no argument about child prostitution happening online. And
So to make a better impact for my community in the Valley or whatever, is it better, as far as schools and all that kind of stuff, is it better to go to the state or is it better to go to just the head of the county or whatever? Because you keep saying different counties handle it different ways, but if the state just overrides it, all the counties have to abide by it, right?
I don't think that's quite the case.
So it's better Stay to local. Go to the head of the county and say, hey, this is what we might be able to do. Because even with the school system, I know it's a lot to do with, it's a certain type of curriculum that every county has to abide by a certain way. Like even adding a new class, me and a lady talked about it earlier about even having a class for young girls in school.
Yeah.
Being able to learn about
So one of the state bills that was just being advocated a couple weeks ago is to bring that education into schools, right? And so there is the state level of that kind of thing. But I mean, I think if you're working with your law enforcement service providers, you need to stay local. Right.
When there's a criminal aspect to it, then the DA comes into it and works with the state.
Right. Okay. So
that way, what this in terms of higher regulation, it takes some of the burden off of the counties and the cities to regulate it, so it frees them up to look at more of the criminal aspect.
Right. No, thanks for that insight. So let me talk about the consumer stuff real quick before we can wrap up with some more questions, because I know that was asked. We like to tell people if California were a country, we'd be the eighth largest economy in the world. And so as we become more aware of slavery in the supply chain of the products we buy, so this might seem kind of like a digression, because we're talking a lot about local trafficking. But the reason we really like to talk about this is because we all have wallets, all of us buy stuff. We could all do something with the way that we buy things. And it may not stop trafficking in California as much. It may impact people more in Africa and people in South America. But it's a way to look at the trafficking issue around the world and the ways that we're involved in it on a daily basis. And fair trade is not anti-trafficking, but fair trade is a way that we guarantee that when you buy fair trade products with one of these stamps, I think this is the Fair Trade USA stamp. There's a couple different fair trade certification organizations that they are... that the people, the producers of these products are getting paid wages so that they're not exploitable and they're not going to have to sell their kids or whatever trafficking situation might happen. So let me just, I'm not going to talk about all these, but Better World Shopper is a great guide for consumers. That also, it's not just a website. You can download it as an ebook or buy an actual paper book. And it rates stuff you buy. You buy your soup. You can see if it's Campbell's is A, B, C, or whatever. You buy your ice cream. Goodguide.com does a similar thing. I'm getting feedback that Free to Work isn't that supported anymore, but they still have a website, I think. It used to be a smartphone app that you could actually use as a barcode reader. You'd go in the store and scan your products to see how they rated. And I would just say, let me promote one group. Trade is one. They do the subscription service. They're based right here in Santa Cruz. That we get it every 3 months. We get this box of fair trade stuff. And it's like $99 for 3 months, so it's like $1 a day. And we get everything from fair trade rice to sugar to chocolates to lotion or soap, teas, whatever. And there's usually recipes to put stuff together. There's a story behind some of the producers. But the cool thing, so it's a sampler, and the whole goal is that you don't just buy fair trade at Christmas when you buy a scarf or a purse for someone. The goal is to change one of your buying habits on a regular basis. And so we realized by getting this box that our kids like quinoa, and we never would have suspected that our kids like fair trade quinoa. So we buy that. That's one of the things in our pantry now that is regularly bought as fair trade. So we don't expect everybody, and we don't advise everybody just to clean out their pantries and start from scratch. But find one or two things that you buy on a daily basis that might be often made by slaves. Here's some of them. And then change those buying habits, and you'll start making a daily impact. Yeah, and you can.
I think this is really an important pillar of, you know, I mean, obviously it's important because it's ultimately creating slavery throughout the world, but for our kids to
look at. And especially, you could especially leverage that around Halloween or Easter or Valentine's Day. And it's very kind of accessible way for churches don't feel ready to talk a lot about sex trafficking and stuff to kind of just start. Let's start with what we buy. And then it's kind of an entry point. Then we like to tell people. We'd like to put a timeline continuum for people to take their next steps. So we ask, it's our 10-10-10. We ask, what can you do in 10 minutes? What can you do in 10 days? What can you do in 10 months? And so these are just suggestions. Everybody will have a different one. And so as you think about it, what can you do in your next 10 minutes, 10 days, 10 months to do something, whether that's putting the hotline in your phone number, whether that's people you can talk to in your household about fair trade stuff, or people you can talk about trafficking in 10 days, do more research, hold an event. You know, Eugene was talking about we all have to be not just convicted, but we have to be educated and equipped. And it's a huge issue. We're always learning more. Each of us can learn more about the issue and do more research, get more training, and spread the word in our circles. I'll put this next slide up in a minute. People are still, looks like they're writing it down. But freedom-summit.org is the website for our Freedom Summit. And that's a great resource. The 56 organizations that were at the last Freedom Summit all have 10-10-10 applications on our website. So you can get some ideas from them. And freedom-summit.org has recordings from the Freedom Summit, which are kind of great. You'll get recordings, I think, from this conference too, but there'll be more stuff you could listen to learn from experts from all around the country. We're just, these are some of the organizations we see as partners. There's freedom-summit.org. It's 12:15. Let me take a couple last questions. Oh, yes. Which one? Freedom Summit? Oh, back one. Oh, yeah. So a few things coming up. This one, I'll pass these out. Susan back here from Sunnyvale Presbyterian Church is helping organize an event on May 14th. Their church has got a great panel of people. If you're in that area, feel free to come by. We'll have those flyers at our table, too. So we'll have a stack of them at the table in the Resource Center.
Any way that you can, on your website, list all the different curriculums that different agencies that are doing that are, like, I don't even care if they're evidence-based, but good, solid curriculums from 12 and up for working with all the different issues that human trafficking victims have. Do you guys have stuff like that, like good curriculums that you can throw out there that we can research?
We don't have a centralized list of it, but we could look into that.
Can I just address that?
Yeah. So there's something pretty close to that. There's a couple of things. So IJM, who's here, they have a Freedom Commons, like a map you can click on and stuff. That one's not as comprehensive as Freedom Registry. Freedom Registry, you can look up by region, by type of things they do.
So the reality is, I mean, there's 2,900 organizations in the Bay Area was the last count. In the U.S. that are fighting trafficking. So to have one centralized place, or when you mentioned curriculums, really, that's going to be the national hotline that really works on bringing that stuff together. And Freedom Registry is a group that is trying to, like, at least has Googled every single group that's working on trafficking. But the issue has been that, I'd say on one hand, if you talk to one group and they actually, like, there's no other way to connect to trafficking except through them, like, they are the movement, that's the very one group you should not be working with. You have to collaborate in this issue. You see all the partners we work with. We had 56 at the last Freedom Summit. But on the other hand, this issue has hit domestic soil, and it has absolutely splintered. So everybody's kind of getting a little bit of money and starting a new little nonprofit here and here. So in the regional space you're working in, that's why we advise get a group that you really feel comfortable with and are vetted in the prevention area, intervention, and aftercare, and start getting that work group to work together. So I agree that on a state level, we need definite regulations, and that needs to kind of be a trickle-down. But a lot of the solutions, we really believe, are community-based, because everybody talks to those different entities differently. And even in the Bay Area, it's very different in Alameda County than it is in Santa Clara County, than it is in Marin, than it is in San Francisco. So really think locally when it comes to how the different actors are actually going to work together to get anything progressively.
So closing thought and two events, and then we'll stick around for questions if you guys, everybody else can go to lunch. May 10th, there's a day of action in San Mateo County. Rose is here, who's organizing a posting of trafficking information according to a state law that requires certain establishments to have trafficking information posted. That's a great way just to get out and volunteer, hands-on, give posters to businesses. May 20th, the week after the Sunnyvale Press event, we have a similar event at Homestead High School. There'll be a panel of experts talking about, if you're in the Cupertino area, come out to that. If you get passionate about this subject, just this last slide, I want to encourage you. You'll probably experience like I did. I started talking about, people started getting to know that I was doing stuff fighting trafficking, and people would see a Facebook post or an article online, and they say, hey, Brian, did you see this? And they send it to me, because they think, oh, Brian's the guy that's into human trafficking. And I have to say, I'm not into human trafficking, but he's the trafficking guy. And so people start seeing it in the news, and they'll say, hey, Brian, did you see this? And rather than saying, oh, this is just too many people talking about it, I love it because it means it's on people's radar and awareness is starting to spread. And I would just encourage you, don't be afraid of becoming the trafficking guy or the trafficking lady in your communities. Because if we each play that role in all of our towns, all of our spheres, then awareness is going to grow, and awareness is the first step to really moving the movement forward. So appreciate you all being here. Thanks for your time, and we'll stick around.